Funding for Think comes from SMU Graduate Liberal Studies programs.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. How did early British settlers in America become something other than English? More than 350,000 men, women, and children moved from England during the 17th century. While they left home for many reasons, most did not wish to leave their Englishness behind, expecting instead to carry what they saw as the best of British values to a new frontier. Yet, as my guest today will tell us, the hardships of life in this new place required people to adapt in order to succeed or even to stay alive. And within just a couple of generations, the roots settlers had put down in North America had begun to take hold and to feel more relevant than the deeper, older roots of their English forebears. Malcolm Gaskell is professor of early modern history at the University of East Anglia. His new book is called Between Two Worlds: How the English Became Americans. Malcolm, welcome to Think.
Thank you very much for having me on the show.
We should state at the outset, there was no single category of early English colonist in the Americas, although this tends to get oversimplified even in the way we tell history here. These people came from lots of different backgrounds for lots of different reasons.
Yeah, that's right. It's a very, very diverse, incredibly varied constituency of people. But of course, about Thanksgiving time, we tend to think of the Pilgrim Fathers. So you have this kind of, you know, creation myth, I suppose, of early America, and the Pilgrim Fathers dominate that role, that position. But actually, behind them, there's a cast of millions, you know, or certainly a cast of hundreds of thousands. And they come from all over England. They go for very different reasons. So colonists come in all shapes and sizes.
Why do you think so many myths have sprung up surrounding the founding of American settlements by English colonists? And what truths do those myths tend to obscure?
Well, I think we all like stories which are simple. You know, we have kind of fairy tales, I suppose, and we have myths about, you know, the way that we began in all sorts of ways. So I think, we, you know, there's a human tendency to simplify things. But the complexity behind it is absolutely enormous. So that in the case of colonization to America, the Pilgrim Fathers go, you know, to New Plymouth, obviously, because they are seeking to, you know, the freedom to worship freely, and they want to move away from the Church of England. But actually, the reasons behind people going to America are so diverse, but perhaps not always quite as romantic or heroic as the story of the Pilgrim Fathers, with everything that goes with it, you know, the Mayflower making it across the Atlantic, and then, of course, the first Thanksgiving. Not everybody has, you know, such edifying stories, I suppose. And so there's a lot of colonists who are kind of lost to history, or if they're not lost, they don't quite fit in with that wholesome image of those first settlers.
What I really loved about this book was that it made me think a lot about the land that we now consider the United States. Yeah. When it wasn't the United States, it was something entirely different.
Sure. Well, one of the really hard things to do is to kind of unthink the USA. You know, this is, we need to sort of go back in time and then try to tell the story forward rather than kind of working back from the history of the states today. Because, of course, I mean, if you drive through Virginia today or drive through Massachusetts, you know, they're so obviously successful and so massive that, you know, historically we can make the mistake of thinking that their success was somehow inevitable. And that all it needed was a few plucky settlers to go there and start things off, and then inevitably you would end up where we are today. But of course, the truth is, an awful lot of colonies failed, and you know they are the also-rans of history, and we don't often know much about them. And if we do, they don't kind of stick in the public national consciousness in the way that the big success stories do.
Did those early settlers have any idea what they were in for in terms of hardship and risk?
I think sometimes they did. There are, of course, some settlers who do go because they're desperate. So that there are an awful lot of young indentured apprentices. And they're not exactly slaves, but they're not quite free either. And that their opportunities in England in the early part of the 17th century are extremely limited. And they're people who are finding it really hard to make a living, and sometimes they feel like they don't have a choice. And even though they know the risks are very great, they go and take their chances. Maybe sometimes it's just because they're young that they feel that they're immortal, or they feel others have failed but they'll succeed. But, you know, typically they don't. and that the majority, certainly in the first couple of decades of Virginia, they don't make it within a few weeks, months, or, you know, even a couple of years if they're lucky. So they sometimes do know the risks, but they go anyway. There are others, I think, actually quite reasonably well informed. The Puritans going to Massachusetts, often they sort of embrace the risks because they've got this idea of themselves as being new Israelites. You know, they like the idea that God is testing them. They don't want it to be too comfortable when they get there, because it doesn't quite fit in with their view of themselves. So again, you know, this is an illustration of the diversity of settlers. They have very different impressions of what America is, and of different and have different expectations accordingly. But you know, there are definitely those who go there who think it's going to be good, and actually it isn't, because, you know, there are private companies in England who are trying to sell stock, sell shares in these companies. And, you know, they put a very positive spin. They write propaganda and they say, you know, America's the land of milk and honey. But actually, when you get there, you find you've got nowhere to live and nothing to eat. And it's incredibly dangerous.
Yeah, it's to think about arriving in a place where there was infrastructure among Native American communities, but that would have looked entirely foreign to these people who arrived. Essentially, they arrived to wilderness.
Yeah, that's absolutely right. I mean, of course, within a few years, you know, these colonies get established, and it's, you know, and people get used to the idea of traveling across the Atlantic. And, you know, and if you arrive in Boston in 1650, 1660, say, well, you know, it looks a little bit like a major European capital on a smaller scale, but it looks familiar. But, you know, when the first ships arrive in Boston in 1630, there is kind of nothing there. I mean, you're quite right that there is. It's, you know, that we can make the mistake of saying there's nothing there, when of course there are Native Americans living there and they have their own society and culture. But this is not familiar, and is in its own time, of course, by European settlers rarely respected for what it is. Of course, these European settlers are very judgmental of Native American culture, and of course often think they're kind of devil worshippers and they need to be corrected and corralled and so on. But, you know, it's for those of them that go there right at the start, from their point of view, there is nothing. And that, you know, those that arrive up the Charles River in 1630, they have to dig burrows into the banks of the river and put tarpaulin over it and just sit it out for a little bit until they can actually organise themselves to find fresh water and to find food and to start to build shelter. So they really do start from scratch. And of course, many of them have actually come from, you know, fairly reasonable communities in England where they've had fairly comfortable homes. And so that you can imagine for a lot of those early settlers, they're thinking, what have we done? You know, did we do the right thing? Am I going to die in this hole in the wilderness? You know?
A fascinating component of this for at least some of these early settlers is that they were leaving England, ironically, because they were nostalgic for an England that was starting to change.
Yeah, this is a very important part of the story, and I think it is sometimes overlooked in American accounts of colonization, is just the extent to which England at this time was changing. And I suppose we probably all experience this a bit in our own lives, the sense that things maybe are not as good as they used to be, perhaps particularly as we get older. You know, you look back and think, well, you know, it was good then and now it's changed. Well, they're like that too. But England is actually changing very, very rapidly in the 17th century. The population has increased dramatically. People are being pushed off the land. There's a sort of, an army of paupers and vagrants. And of course, politically, the country's extremely turbulent. And then in the middle of the 17th century, England, of course, has a civil war and the king is actually executed. So everything is in turmoil. And so all those things put together, you know, do make people think, well, actually, you know, England was great once. Maybe it's a myth they're telling themselves. Maybe it's just a fable. But some people are nostalgic for the days of Elizabeth I in the 16th century and think, you know, neighbours used to be nice to each other. And actually the church used to be, didn't feel oppressive. And, you know, we could worship freely according to the truth of the Bible and all these kinds of thoughts. And of course, for these sorts of nostalgic ideas, America becomes a screen onto which you can project your fantasies, I suppose, of an England that you think you know, may once have existed and was much better than the one that you're experiencing at that time.
So it's interesting because the premise of the book is that these early settlers expected to transfer sort of English culture and identity to life in this new place. But already, if you are looking to take everything you loved and leave behind what you didn't like, you're already setting yourself up for great change.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. And of course, that, you know, disappointment is always geared to expectation, isn't it? So
yeah.
That, you know, that in some ways that their expectation is sky high about what they could achieve. It becomes it's a sort of a pipe dream for some people. So it's never, ever going to quite work out the way that you thought it was going to work out. And so that actually the act of trying to stay the same, you know, to reproduce English life across the Atlantic, and perhaps particularly the dream of trying to turn back the clock and, you know, recreate some kind of nostalgic fantasy of what England may or may not ever have been like. Well, this takes a lot of work. And so that these colonists perhaps think that they're going to stay the same. And, you know, they have varying degrees of success, mostly not much success. But what they definitely are doing is working incredibly hard at an incredible speed. And I think this is something that, you know, does have a powerful legacy in the history of America.
Can you talk about how, Malcolm, different groups of individuals made choices about where to site their colonies just geographically in North America?
Yeah, well, the law of unintended consequences often kicks in at this point because they don't always end up where they think they're going to end up. So, you know, it's a lesser known fact that the Mayflower passengers, that they're trying to go to Virginia, but you know they're always at the mercy of the weather and they can't get down that far south and they realise they're going to have to land. And so they end up in, you know, that part of New England that now seems iconic, but was actually rather accidental. There are those who try to identify certain areas where they're going to get particular resources, which then they can export back to England. So that, for example, you know, on the New England coast and up into Maine, you know, these are very rich fishing waters, so that there's an idea you can get cod there, you can salt it, you can send it down to the Caribbean, you can export it to Europe. So that's one example. But they're always looking for commodities, be they, it could be tar, it could be pitch, there could be all sorts of things which are actually imported, say, from the Baltic areas of Eastern Europe and Northern Europe, where actually, you know, if we can get them from America for nothing, then we can improve our balance of payments. That's the kind of idea. So in Virginia, well, they try all sorts of things. They think, well, actually, we can grow silk there and we can have vineyards there and we won't be dependent on France anymore. Actually, what they grow is tobacco. It's, you know, it's the easiest thing to do. And vineyards are very, very hard to get going. So there are all these projects and they nearly all fail because actually the thing which is really going to sell is tobacco. And of course, you know, we still live with the legacy of that. So that, you know, there's quite a lot known about America, particularly, you know, by the 1620s, 1630s. There's quite a lot being written so that investors, you know, can choose accordingly.
My guest is Malcolm Gaskell. He is professor of early modern history at the University of East Anglia and author of the new book Between Two Worlds, How the English Became Americans. You can be part of our conversation by calling in now to 1-800-933-5372. You can email think@kera.org or send me a tweet at Chris Boyd Think.
Funding for Think comes from SMU Graduate Liberal Studies programs. Accepting applications for January to design your own Master of Liberal Studies degree at SMU with concentrations in Global Studies, Creative Writing, and Organizational Dynamics. More at smu.edu/MLS.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. I'm speaking this hour with Malcolm Gaskill, who is professor of early modern history at the University of East Anglia and author of the new book Between Two Worlds, How the English Became Americans. Join the conversation at 1-800-933-5372 or email think@kera.org. Malcolm, for those who came here primarily, and of course there are always mixed motivations, but primarily to make money, what kind of patronage did they have from investors who remained in England, and what was expected of those colonists in return?
Well, they're very dependent on those investors or adventurers, as they're sometimes known, because the crown, you know, the kings and queens of the late 16th and 17th centuries, you know, they always want to put their stamp of approval on the in these colonial ventures, but they're never prepared to put any money into it. So these things entirely rely on these private companies. And so there are big investors, and there are those who run the companies, and then there are the small stockholders who are sometimes in just for a few shillings. You know, you can buy very, very small shares. And so that really you're kind of, these companies depend entirely on their investors to, you know, to, well, for example, to raise enough money so that you can actually load a ship with supplies, so you can send it off to the colony that you founded so that everybody doesn't starve to death. And then try and stop everybody getting on the empty ship when it comes back because, you know, they're not really enjoying themselves very much. So that the stakes are actually very high, and they're often running on very, very tight margins. And the Virginia Company famously actually runs a couple of lotteries, national lotteries in England, just to try to get enough money together to load up one of these ships to send over. So that, you know, they're really rather desperate a lot of the time, and that the Virginia Company does kind of ultimately fold. But then the colony becomes a royal colony in the 1620s, and the crown does then nominally take it over. But essentially, these are private, you know, enterprise ventures, and people, you know, put a few pounds behind it, and sometimes they succeed and sometimes they don't. But the expectations are always going to be that, you know, the colonies are going to be successful, they're going to organise themselves, they're going to be politically sound, they're going to introduce some laws, they're going to have a proper English type hierarchy, and that as a result they will start to send things back, could be timber, could be fish, could be silk or whatever, and that this will then be the profit, that this will make the profit that the stockholders were expecting. But it's so hard for most of them. And again, this is why for Virginia tobacco is so important, because at last you've got a product that you can, you know, stick in a barrel, send over to London, it goes on sale immediately, you don't have to do anything to it, it's there, you can just sell it. And so that the King, James I, who absolutely hates smoking, is always saying to the Virginia Company, you know, you'd be much better if you invested in some, you know, you could make wine over there, you could make glass, you can do all sorts of things. And they say, yes, yes, very interesting, Your Majesty. And then they just make tobacco, you know.
What kind of experience would the colonists have had with any kind of combat and particularly the sort of conflict that they would face, you know, meeting up with Native Americans who did not welcome their arrival?
Yeah, it's a constant problem. I mean, those who arrive at Jamestown in 1607, the start of Virginia, you know, nearly all of them have some kind of military experience. They are essentially soldiers building a kind of an outpost of empire, very much on an older model. So there's a big contrast between Jamestown, Virginia, and, say, New Plymouth in the 1620s, which is like a little English community transplanted, where they, you know, they do you know, radical things like take women with them and have families, and that makes them incredibly successful. So that those at Jamestown, they're actually reasonably well prepared because they are already experienced soldiers. Quite a lot of them have, for example, fought in the campaigns in Ireland at the end of the 16th century. So they've got some kind of experience of colonisation, some experience of the hostility of indigenous peoples, and, you know, and how to suppress them. But the problem for, of course, the more sort of peace-loving, I suppose, colonists, or those who don't have that kind of experience, is they're expected to be farmers as well as soldiers. And so this becomes a problem across the 17th century, that colonies ideally kind of need garrisons, because you need to leave people to farm, but then you also need people to protect the colony. But again, these are questions of money. And so that when, you know, there are attacks, that inevitably militias have to be gathered together, they have to be trained, these farmers have to give up their time. And when there were really some really terrible wars happen, especially in the 1670s, then you find that the communities essentially become abandoned. The men all go away and they all have to fight. And that has, you know, terrible emotional and economic consequences for those townships.
Well, let's talk about King Philip's War. And I shudder to think the small percentage of Americans who could tell you what that actually is, if, you know, held to account on this. But this has all been all but forgotten in American history. But not only was it devastating, it was also this like really decisive moment in terms of forging an American identity that was separate from the English identity.
It was, absolutely. And you know, never mind Americans have never heard of this. You know, what about British people have never heard of this? This is a, you know, this is a British war in America. And it seems that that everybody's forgotten it. It's proportionally the most devastating war that America has ever fought. You know, it's worse than the First and Second World War. It's worse than Vietnam. It's absolutely devastating because it, you know, it's not only just the number of people who die. So maybe, you know, 2,000, you know, able-bodied men that die. Now, that's an awful lot at that period of time. You know, maybe 1 in 10, say, of able-bodied men die. You know, there are dozens of townships which are razed to the ground that have taken decades to build. 12 towns are destroyed entirely. This is, you know, it's incredibly expensive as well. You know, these wars cost money. Where does the money come from? Well, essentially, it's going to come from taxation of these people. So, you know, it sort of sucks the lifeblood out of the community. And England doesn't help. You know, there's no help that comes from England. Now, of course, actually, subsequently, I think the colonists are rather pleased from this because then they could say, we did this on our own. And I think that that contributes to this, the extent to which King Philip's War is a sort of a transformative rite of passage where colonies, you know, not only fight an enemy on their own, but they also club together. Because before this, colonies actually don't have much to do with each other. They're often quite hostile towards one another. But, you know, there is a realization in the 1670s that if the colonies don't actually club together, then they're never going to fight off the threat. And, of course, you know, they don't know what's going to happen a century later. But, you know, you can start to see where some of those revolutionary principles are seeded back in an earlier American past.
Just to be clear here, the conflict was between English settlers and native peoples. Can you talk about how what had been sort of skirmishes all along exploded into something that could definitely be called a war?
Yeah. Well, again, the mirror image, I suppose, of the English colonies clubbing together is that there are American nations and tribes who also club together. And they have historically often been at war with one another. So that, again, it's kind of one of the tragedies of Native American people that the colonists were actually able to divide and rule because there were already conflicts that existed between them. So you get wars, well, particularly of the 1690s, where you get, of course, there are certain American nations on the French side, certain American nations on the English side, and they're fighting a European war, when actually really the ideal thing for the Native Americans has been on the same side. But they are in large numbers in the 1670s during King Philip's War. So that you get these kind of, there are some quite bad wars before, the Pequot Wars of the 1630s. Was extremely severe, but much more limited. But what happens in the 1670s is because of this collaboration between the Native American side and between the English side, the war is fought on a much bigger scale. And it's actually, by that point, I think it is a recognition of the fact that really, you know, enough is enough. That the Native American nations are being pushed constantly, almost literally, by the expansion of English territory, and that you just reach a point where really the English have to be stopped. So for quite a lot of the time, actually, that, you know, there are Native American nations and tribes who think, well, you know, it's quite good that the English are here. We can trade with them. We can get weapons. We can get tools from them. You know, this is good for us economically, But the when actually when the land really starts disappearing and they find they've got nowhere to live, then this is what happens in the 1670s, where the chief Metacom, or King Philip as the English know him, decides to fight back.
Does that collaborative effort by people from a variety of different colonies and on the other side, people from a variety of different Native American nations, does that really mark the genesis of the sense that English settlers had, that they had a right to this land that had been, in fact, occupied before they arrived?
It certainly encourages it. I mean, you can see it in Virginia 50 years earlier, where there is an Indian uprising in 1622. And before that time, that the English have been saying, look, you know, we need to kind of, you know, be very diplomatic with the Indians. There's very few of us, and, you know, we need to kind of make peace with them. But when this uprising happens and there are 347 English colonists are killed, now that's the third of all the English people in America, well, then there is a massive backlash. And at that point, the English start to think, right, now the gloves are off, we can do whatever we like, we can take whatever land we want. And so it's often sometimes the English seem very conciliatory and seem sometimes rather gentle towards Native Americans. But actually then when they feel that they're being challenged or that the Indians are resisting in some way, then actually the backlash and the cruelty with that is often disproportionate. And this puzzles the Indians because there's a tradition in Native American warfare that, you know, have very limited, almost set piece battles and wars, which are rather symbolic, and they just redress the balance. What the English bring is a tradition of European warfare, which is just like total war, like a fight to the death. So that the Indians are part of the tragedy is that it's just so, you know, they don't quite understand how far that the English are prepared to go in order to win absolutely.
There was obviously like an excruciating time lag in communications across the Atlantic, but can you characterize the nature of the communications and the orders that would come down from, say, the crown to colonial governors? And did they have, did it have more or less impact than the communication that would come to colonial governors from those investors, those adventurers back in England?
Yeah. Well, when we tend to think, of course, that these communications are agonizingly slow, of course, they don't know any difference, so that they don't, you know, they. So what would kind of feel intolerable to us? I mean, we're sort of impatient, I suppose, because everything can happen, you know, happens more or less instantly. So, but, you know, you probably wait sort of 6 weeks for a letter or so, but quite often that from both sides of the Atlantic, the letters are being fired off constantly. So there's always a sort of a rolling, passage of mail going from one side to the other. And sometimes colonists will write the letter several times and put it on different ships to make it absolutely certain it's going to get there. So, but of course you can't respond, you know, you can't respond instantly. And so that there are these messages, say, that come from the Crown to the Virginia Company in London, who then send them on to the Virginia Company, you know, on the American side. And, well, you know, sometimes they say, oh, we never received it. Or sometimes they get it and they think, well, we'll sort of interpret that within the spirit of local conditions. So that it's partly a time lag, but it's also a sort of a distance lag, if that makes sense, which is really like, well, we can't actually really enforce that law in the way that they want us to, but we'll sort of do it. But then, you know, they don't understand what it's like over here. And in those kind of thoughts, I think you're starting to already get the genesis of something. Well, maybe it's not necessarily an American identity, but it's certainly not quite an English one if you're starting to think they don't understand us. Because when you talk about they, you're talking about somebody else, and they're talking about the people back home. So that you get this an awful lot from both from colonists and administrators on the ground who are being told what to do by people in England. It's like, well, you know, we just can't do that, so we'll tell them we're kind of doing that and hope for the best. And often they get away with it because, of course, who checks up on them? You know, it's impossible to actually, you know, inspect what they're doing half the time.
And then it didn't take long at all, just a generation or two, before the majority of British subjects living in America had no firsthand knowledge of England whatsoever.
Well, that can certainly happen. And I think particularly in more remote areas, there are, you know, if you live in Boston, I think you kind of always know what's happening in England because there are always ships coming in. That, you know, they always bring newspapers with them. People read these things to pieces. News passes by word of mouth. But in more remote territories, further away from these things, I think that not only does the information not, you know, sort of percolate through to them, but there's less interest in what's happening. England becomes almost a sort of a romantic far-off place where, you know, you knew that your father or your grandfather came from there, but, you know, and there's perhaps there is a kind of, you know, that there's a faint kind of fascination with it, but there isn't the same kind of direct contact as there was in the first generation. So it's not to say that there was, you know, throughout the 17th and into the 18th centuries, you know, there are many thousands of people in America who still have family and friends and contacts in England and still make the journey across the Atlantic to visit them and conduct business and so on. But equally, there are those colonists who have sort of gone off that kind of radar and are living a life, I suppose we might call it a frontier sort of existence, where their lives are not directly, you know, affected by some kind of English legacy or some kind of ongoing English connection, but are very much, you know, shaped and determined by the experience of where they live, which can often be a hostile environment, but is always a very different environment from the one that anyone's used to in England.
Malcolm Gaskell is my guest. He is professor of early modern history at the University of East Anglia and author of the new book Between Two Worlds, How the English Became Americans. You can be part of our conversation by calling in to 1-800-933-5372. You can email think@kera.org or send me a tweet at Chris Boyd Think.
Funding for Think comes from SMU Graduate Liberal Studies programs. Accepting applications for January to design your own Master of Liberal Studies degree at SMU with concentrations in Global Studies, Creative Writing, and Organizational Dynamics. More at smu.edu/MLS.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. We're speaking this hour with Malcolm Gaskell, who is professor of early modern history at the University of East Anglia and author of the new book Between Two Worlds, How the English Became Americans. Join us at 1-800-933-5372. Malcolm, you alluded to this earlier, but maybe you can speak more about it. The era of colonization in America is something that we sort of imagine as a very American bit of history. But in fact, things were changing in England as well. And so you have ultimately like a parallel but ever more divergent evolution on both sides of the Atlantic.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, I think that, you know, I don't want to sort of, you know, malign any American historians here or any British ones either, but they're not always kind of as interested in what's happening the other side of the opposite side of the Atlantic as I think that they should be. And so they are often like parallel lives or they're intertwined lives, particularly because of the traffic of colonists going, you know, both ways across the ocean. So these are, you know, histories that are very closely connected and that, you know, national events, say like the execution of Charles I in 1649, well, that sends a big ripple through all the American colonies because they are still nominally subjects of the English crown and they've got to kind of respond in the right way. Now, Massachusetts Bay Colony, for example, which, you know, is always seen as a sort of disloyal colony to England, is seen as very Puritan when, and you know, Puritans, of course, are the enemies of Charles I during the English Civil War, that, you know, that the, when actually the king comes back in 1660, that, that Massachusetts Bay has to say, oh, no, well, actually, we were very loyal all along, when, of course, in the 1650s, it's just an open secret that they were rather pleased that the king was executed and were rather happy to have England as a republic, because, of course, that fitted in with their kind of political and religious vision. So that, you know, you can't be a colonist and just ignore England. You sort of, just from a political point of view, you have to kind of take an interest. And perhaps even more than that, you sort of have to toe the line, because, you know, if it's 6 weeks away across the Atlantic, at some point there could be soldiers coming over. And actually that's what happens in the mid-1670s, when there's a rebellion in Virginia. At this point, actually, that this is a rebellion called Bacon's Rebellion, that, you know, English soldiers do arrive. And again, it's a kind of a foretaste of what's going to happen a century later.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's speak on the phone now with Ed in Arlington. Hello, Ed.
Hi, Mr. Gascombe.
Hi, Ed.
There's a very thick vein of English and European history having to do with colonialism.
Yeah.
And yet my limited understanding of that doesn't really seem to describe the American experience in the New World very much. In my studies of American history, I don't think I've heard ever, or at least very often, any reference to the English governor in the colonies or the royal governor, and yet that seems to be a focal point of unrest in other English colonies, overseas colonies, like... And I guess the biggest one would be India, but I think the English were also involved in Malaysia, and back in the New World there was Belize, and I don't know, maybe I'm leaving a lot out, but...
Well, the British, the 19th century, of course, the British Empire is absolutely enormous, and so that many of these kind of these relationships and attitudes are being laid down in the American colonies in the 17th century already. Yeah, that's right.
Was there another part to your question, Ed?
Well, now he answered it very succinctly. I have to say no. That pretty well sums it up.
All right, terrific. Thank you so much for your call.
Thanks, Ed.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Malcolm, at what point in history, and I realize you can't put your finger on an exact date, but would English American settlers and their descendants have been sort of universally recognized as distinct from people who had never left the motherland?
That's a good question. It's a very hard one to answer. I mean, you're starting to get, you know, towards the end of the 17th century, say, let's say sort of the 1680s, 1690s, you know, a New Englander who would come over to London, or maybe actually, let's say, out into the provinces, would actually be treated with a lot of interest, even a kind of fascination, as if this is, was slightly exotic sort of traveller. You know, English people were interested in what was happening in America. Sometimes it's a sort of a slightly sort of ghoulish interest, especially when there are wars and so on going on. I think there's something fascinating about the New Englander who might be seen as somehow rebellious against England. So that they're recognised as such. I think that there is also a kind of, there are some sort of national characteristics in New Englanders that sort of seep into English jokes by the end of the 17th century. Now, I can't think of any offhand, and they're not particularly funny, so probably not quite worth retelling, but there are sort of national characteristics, I suppose, kind of slightly sort of xenophobic stereotypes of what New Englanders were like. So they're often seen in England as sort of crafty, and that they would kind of cheat you in business, and you have to be very, very careful because they're incredibly canny and sharp. So these are sort of, you know, these are just sort of cultural associations which are being made with people who start out as English in America, but actually by this point have obviously evolved into something which can be seen slightly more objectively by an English person and seen therefore as different.
Is it surprising, or should it be surprising, that it took a century after the first shift in loyalties between colonists and the crown that came about with King Philip's War for colonists to launch a formal demand for independence?
No, I think we have to be careful. I think when we look back, say, to things like King Philip's War or Bacon's Rebellion, because, you know, there are sort of seeds, I suppose, of rebellion, but they're not seeds that necessarily are going to start germinating and growing, you know, that they're dormant seeds. And we can sort of misread the ambitions and intentions, I think. What a lot of the protest that you find in America in the 17th century is not we want to be independent from you, but we want to be governed fairly according to English tradition. So that there are English kings in the 17th century who people in England feel are kind of riding roughshod over English liberties, the rights of the freeborn Englishmen. They're behaving like kind of French absolutist monarchs, like dictators almost. So that the protests you get in America are just, we want to be treated like English people, you know, not that we want to be treated like Americans. So I think that that is the shift, I think, that takes place over the course of the first three quarters of the 18th century, where the rebellion becomes something rather different. And it becomes a revolution by the 1770s, much more like the way we think of modern revolutions like the French Revolution or the Russian Revolution, where actually you get rid of the old order and you build a new one. Whereas the cry for rebellion or revolution, if you want to call it that, in the 17th century is more, let's go back to the way things were. Again, it's this sort of nostalgic idea of, you know, stop spoiling England, you know, stop spoiling our sense of who we are as English subjects and let us be the freeborn English people abroad that we think we are.
What kinds of events and conditions do you think made the culture and the temperament of Americans different from their English ancestors?
I think that, sometimes these things are, these changes, I think, are created by adverse experiences of war and of the wilderness and of the frontier and of and feeling isolated. And all those things, I think, are transformative experiences. But, you know, England is also undergoing its own kinds of, you know, traumas and rebellions. But, you know, it's never quite the same because, in New England in the 1670s, there's a real threat there's a real chance that New England might cease to exist. Now, whatever's going on in England, there's always this sense underneath it that, you know, England isn't going to cease to exist. And I think that feeling is totally different for a colonist. That's a totally separate set of circumstances that makes you feel different about yourself and about where you're going. And so that there's also on top of this, you know, you can see it from the 1650s, but it's even greater after the 1670s, that, you know, God is kind of protecting us, God is guiding us, and that this is really what we came here to do, and that we're doing it on our own, and we're not doing it, you know, we still think of ourselves as English, but we're essentially able to make this world for ourselves and guide ourselves. Now, as we said, you know, it's actually quite a long journey from that to thinking we want to be independent. But certainly that kind of sense of self-righteous confidence and that sense of purpose and direction, I think, are very much created by the experience of warfare and of hardship and adversity of living so far from home.
That sense that we were self-sufficient makes sense given what you just described. Of course, very few people would have acknowledged that that was made possible in large part by slave labor in different parts of what is now the United States.
Yeah, it's one of those greater ironies of American history that liberty has to be connected to bondage, and of course that slavery looms so large in U.S. history. This is a rather familiar point. But if you look at the whole of English America in the 17th century, that, you know, there are slaves in New England, more than sometimes thought, but it's nothing on the scale to the way that slaves are used in the Chesapeake Bay area, particularly in Virginia, and most particularly in actually what is the most significant part of English America, which is the West Indies and the Caribbean. Now, that's often kind of ignored in early American history because so much of the Caribbean, the West Indies, stay part of the British Empire after the colonies are lost, as it were. But they're actually an integral part of the of early American history, particularly because of the way that the colonies in New England depend upon the Caribbean as a market to export food to, because the West Indies, the sugar plantations, are specialising so much they're just not growing their own food. They're only going to make sugar because that is like that's the new gold. So, and that depends very much on slave labour. So you might think the New England, well, we didn't really have much to do with slavery, but actually they're kind of complicit in an economic structure which entirely supports slavery and of course, indeed encourages it enormously.
Are there lessons that could be derived from this story that might help us put the experiences and acculturation process of even contemporary immigrants into perspective?
Yeah, well, of course, it was once said that, you know, nobody learns anything from history except for the fact that nobody learns anything from history. But you do see resonances in it, and I don't think it's reading, you know, too much into it to try to understand the way that you can, for example, European encounters with Native Americans, that you can tell that kind of story different ways. You can look at it as a frontier across which, you know, that English influence has passed, but you can tell the story a different way, that actually it is there are zones of exchange and that both sides get affected by the other. And so, of course, it's always a very one-sided thing, and we know the way these stories finish, but you know, there's an enormous differential of power between the Europeans and the Native Americans. But that actually on the cultural level, just to sort of address your question directly, that, you know, we can learn about the way that people try to learn about each other and the limits that there are of trying to make people fit in with your vision. And that, you know, on the ground sometimes in colonies, they do learn the hard way. And I think they do start to realise within local economies that, you know, the limits of what can be done. So that, you know, there's a colony which set up in Massachusetts called Springfield, and that there, the leader of that colony, William Pynchon, he understands right from the start that everybody is going to treat the local Indians fairly according to English law, because if you don't, then you're never, ever going to have peace. So that, you know, that these things are kind of worked out at the local level. And that essentially that if you want to go and make money in a colony, you really want peace, because war's expensive and it distracts from everything. So although we sometimes think about these things, people as modern conquistador, and that often, you know, that the wars they fight are utterly destructive to Native American culture, most of the time, actually, the English want to try to get along with the locals because that's the best way of making the profits that you need to send home.
What would you say, we just have about 30 seconds left, but what would you say are the lingering effects on American culture, besides our language, of our long association with England?
Well, that's a good one to save to last. It's a really hard one. I suppose that, you know, that sometimes that there is a kind of a romance of the old world. I mean, certainly if you look in the post-revolutionary era, there's a sort of a contempt for the old world that's still run by kings and bishops, but there's always a kind of a romance too. So, you know, the old world, you know, it's a sense it is seen as the opposite of the new world. But, of course, the stories are intertwined, and I think that, you know, there'll always be that special relationship historically.
Malcolm Gaskill is professor of early modern history at the University of East Anglia. His new book is called Between Two Worlds: How the English Became Americans. Malcolm, it's been a fascinating discussion. Thank you so much for making time
for
us.
Thank you so much indeed.
Think is produced by Stephen Becker and engineered today by Alan Roberts. Lindsay Connect is assistant producer. Jeff Whittington is executive producer. You can find me on Twitter at Chris Boyd Think, and you can contact the show via email at think@kera.org. Once again, I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening and have a great day.